What happens after we pass from this world? Is there a life after this one? Jay Wiedner thinks so, and his latest work, Sacred Mysteries Infinity, The Ultimate Trip, Journey Beyond Death. We're going to talk with Jay about that and much more when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Jay Wiedner, author, filmmaker, co-author of numerous works, and he's produced and directed documentary films, 2012, The Odyssey, Secrets of Alchemy, Earth Under Fire, and many others. Since 2000, Jay Wiedner has been the president of Sacred Mysteries Productions. Now, that's a company dedicated to producing high-quality films that challenge perceptions and help understand the nature of reality. Tonight, we talk with Jay about his recent work about life after death. He's back on Coast to Coast. Hey, Jay, how are you?
I'm great, George. How are you?
Good. You've been busy.
I have been. Never a dull moment.
No, not at all. And your Sacred Mystery seems to be doing really well these days.
They are. It's one of the few businesses probably doing well in this economy because I think, well, we're offering hope, I think, to people and spiritual sustenance in a desperate time, you know.
You've jumped into life after death. Tell me why.
Well, that's an interesting story. It began in 2002. When my mother was diagnosed with cancer, and I was, you know, steeped in metaphysical concepts and esoteria and things, and thought that this would be no problem. I could talk to her and, you know, ease her fears about what was about to happen, and it didn't work. She was still, you know, filled with fear, and nothing I said could convince her that there was nothing to fear outside of course the pain. And she passed away in late 2002, and I was very depressed about it. And one night I was out to dinner with my friend Alberto Violdo, and I was telling him about it, and he had gone through a similar experience when his father had died. And slowly over the next 2 or 3 years, we developed this idea that we needed to make a film that anyone could see to, you know, help ease those fears and show what's really going on at death and after death, but mostly to show your loved ones, your family, your friends who might be going through this experience, and to help them not be fearful. And so that was the real point of the whole thing was, you know, pop the DVD in and show your loved ones a beautiful film filled with optimism and stories about death and life after death. But not just that, the infinite nature of reality. You know, this reality, we're constantly being told by our leaders that everything in this world and universe is finite. And that's actually not true. We live in an infinite universe of infinite possibilities. And so there's that, and there were a lot of other motivations. Another motivation for making the film was, frankly, a little bit of a subversive reason, and that is that I knew that if people realized that there was no such thing as death, not really, then they would no longer be afraid of their lives. And if they are no longer afraid of their lives, then no one could tell them what to do. And maybe trying to foment a quiet revolution in the way that we view ourselves and the world. And once we realize that there's no such thing as death, then I think we're going to be liberated from the political and social environment that we've been thrust into. And I think all the ancient spiritual traditions were trying to do that, but we've lost track somewhere along the way, and now I'm trying, and we're all trying, I think you're trying, we're all trying to get back on track to this kind of place where we can face up to our lives without being fearful of death, of life, of each other, of politicians, of governments. And when that happens, they better run for the hills because they can't tell us what to do anymore. And I think that moment is nearer than we think. I really do.
When you put together your work for this particular documentary, Infinity, The Ultimate Trip, Journey Beyond Death, how did you go about researching it? How'd you put the pieces together?
Well, it started out, it's actually quite a fascinating story because I actually didn't write the film. It wrote itself. It was written by a series of strange synchronicities and coincidences that kept occurring, and I just kept following every synchronicity and bringing the camera crew along and filming everything I could. And at first, I had a very clinical film and wasn't real happy with it. It took 4 years to make the film, but after a while, I started gathering really incredible interviews like the one with Renata Dollinger about her experiences escaping Germany and meeting a person who told her her entire life and what it would be, and it all came true. And stories like that until I realized that I had this body of stories that were all interrelated that told this story about infinity. And so I read a lot of books. I read, you know, Stanislav Grof's books on death, and I read my friend Daniel Brinkley's books and a lot of other people's books. But it really, truly did write itself, and I was really gratified when I finally sat down and started editing it, how smoothly it all just went together and how it just made total sense, and I didn't have to intrude or put any narration or subtitles or anything in it. It just kind of unfolded like a dream, and that I'm really proud. So I think it's definitely Sacred Mystery's best film and my best film, and we're getting rave reviews, and everybody loves it and everything. But the real point of it is that We all must face this moment at the end of our lives, but what does it mean? And I think we have to understand that we're higher dimensional beings who are encased in a body. And just because the body stops breathing doesn't mean your higher dimensional self doesn't go on living. It does go on living. And once you realize that, you not only have no fear of death, but you have a great sense of compassion for your fellow living beings, whether they be animals or plants or humans, because they all possess a higher dimensional self that from which they came from and for which they are going to return. And I think that is the kind of the narrative that we've lost here in the West. We don't. It's a well-known fact that the Catholic Church actually believes in reincarnation, but they don't think it should be taught as a doctrine because it will make people not try very hard in this life, supposedly, and they'll just wait for their next life to start their work. Well, I don't know if I buy that. You know, it's a good reason. Either way, I think now at this point in time, with the overflow of information coming in all directions, it's time to let people know that 90% of the rest of the world has another point of view, which is that we have an infinite nature and we're infinite beings and we're on a giant quest to achieve a certain kind of understanding of this universe. And the Catholics teach that, and the Hindus teach that, and the Buddhists, and the Muslims, and the Jews, and the indigenous peoples teach this. It's a universal construct of ideas that we are beginning to come back to and come to grips with. And when we do, we will be free of the pain that we go through every day, thinking that we have to gather everything now, that we have to get as much as we can now. And when we realize that after we die, we're coming back, we're not going to be so destructive of the environment because we got to come back to this. And so a lot of dynamic changes can come about once we change our idea of the fact that we are not finite, we're infinite beings, and that there really is no such thing as death. And that is really the, I guess you could say, the subversive reasons for the film. And it must be doing the right thing because I'm getting hundreds and hundreds of emails every week, and we're getting all these reviews about it. And I haven't really, you know, I finished the film over a year ago, and I'm off on other projects now. The one funny thing about filmmaking is it takes so long to finish a film, and then
sure does.
Yeah, yeah, and then you got to put it out, and so you kind of forget what the film was about. So before I came on, I watched the film a couple of days ago, and I went, "Oh yeah, this is pretty good."
Well, you've got some great players in this as well. It's almost like a mini who's who of past Coast to Coast guests.
You've got
some good people there.
Danyon Brinkley and
Brian
John Weiss. Holland.
You got them all.
Yeah, Greg Braden, and so many people wanted to be in it. That was the other interesting thing about this film. Usually we have to cajole people to be in our film, but I would just say a couple sentences to, say, Danyon Brinkley, and he was immediately on board with it. And they all love it, and they're very proud of their being in the film, and I'm very happy that they decided to participate, because it's one of those things that, you know, if nothing else, it's filled with a lot of good karma. So just by making it, maybe I'll be redeemed for any of the bad things I've done.
Well, you know, I have a simple formula, Jay, and that is enjoy your life to its fullest. But when the time is up, the time is up.
It is. And one of the things I like about the film and the ideas is this whole idea of the past life review, and this idea that, you know, you're going to live your entire life again when you die, like watching a video recording. And you want to make sure that your film that you watch at the end of your life is the best film that you can possibly make. So no matter what you've done in your life that you're ashamed of or that you don't feel good about, or a divorce or whatever it is, you know, you still have a chance to redeem yourself, and you can start right now. And I think that's another message in the film that I wanted to get across, that, you know, it's never too late to come back to compassion and loving each other and treating each other kindly. And that kind of thing. And that's another thing I think we need in this society now, especially with this economic crisis that we're under and things like that. So when you see a guy asking for, you know, some money, and you know it's probably going to go to alcohol or drugs, you know, maybe you ought to still help him, because there's still a chance that in that one moment he can be redeemed, or they can be redeemed too.
William, well, why don't you go get him a hamburger?
That's an even better idea. Instead of having them go out and buy something that's going to be bad for them, go get them some food.
I had a friend who did that. Somebody was begging for money. He was convinced it was going to go and buy a little pint or something else. He went and said, "What do you want the money for?" He said, "I just want to get a hamburger." So he went and got it for him, brought it back. And as he was driving away, my friend, as he was driving away, he looks in his rearview mirror. The guy's tossing the hamburger over the bridge.
Yes, well, there's always failure too, but you still have to try, and it's good that he did that. I do that too. I'll see somebody out there in the rain, you know, begging for money or whatever, and I'll go buy them a latte or a cup of tea or something, and I've seen them pour it out. So, but still, you know, you need to do it, and this world is. We are being judged. We're not being judged severely. We're actually the judge and jury and the defending attorney of ourselves. And when we die, we kind of go into a trial. There's a great movie called Defending Your Life with Albert Brooks and Shirley MacLaine. Oh, it's a great movie. And he, you know, he goes through his past life reviews, and he finds he's just one failure after another, right? And but still, you know, you have to try, and you have to be, you know, whatever it is that you can be in this world, because you just never know when the final time comes. There's a difference between you may not be in a constantly reoccurring reincarnation state. It may only be a few lives, and so you never know when, you know, you have gone too far and you've used up all of your good karma, and now it's time for you to actually end your cycle of existence. And this is a definite possibility too, which is where I think the Christian religion gets their concepts of heaven and hell and things. So You know, just because you may be coming back in a reincarnation doesn't mean you can be lazy now and not try. And I think once we get this idea into our heads, I think the society and our culture is immediately going to begin repairing itself. And I think that in the end, it's a better thing that we do if we try to help each other now and not wait.
Tell me a little bit more about this life review. What's its real purpose?
Its real purpose, the interesting thing about this life review I found was not just that you go through this life backwards in some cases, meeting all the people that you met and seeing the good and the bad that you've done, but you actually live the things that you did to other people through them. So if you committed a nasty act to someone, you've got to go through what that person went through. And if you did something nice to someone, you also get to go through that too. So there's two sides of the coin. And I think that that's actually the most interesting part of it. For instance, you know, you could a kid could be drafted into a war and do a lot of terrible things in a war. And in the past life, he has to go through all of the pain that he put down on people. So if you did have some unfortunate incidences when you were early in life, make sure that you spend the rest of your life doing as much good as you can in this world so that that little nasty thing that you did early on isn't so bad during the past life review. I can imagine that a past life review can actually be quite embarrassing, I would imagine, to a lot of people, especially they look back into their youth and see all the silly things that they believed and the silly things that they did and the cruel things that they did to people. And so, you know, it's important for us to realize that it just because you did something bad some other time in your life, there's plenty of time to make up for it. You know, Danyon Brinkley goes around hugging everybody. He's the hug monster.
He does.
And he hugs you, and he's huge, and he about breaks your ribs when he hugs you. But you know what? He's passing out so much good karma that in the end, you know, he's going to have a million hugs before he gets to anything bad that he did. And that's really a good attitude to take, I think.
If you've done a lot of good things in your life, though, does that show up in the life review as well, or just the
absolutely
bad things?
Absolutely, that yes, and you don't know what you've done. You know, you don't. The thing about good, you know, you did bad things, but the thing about good things is you just never know what you really did. You could have, you know, recommended someone for a promotion and changed their entire life, or maybe you asked a girl to dance who had never been asked to dance before and changed her entire life. You just don't know. There's a million little conduits that you can go down, and each one of them has ramifications. And, you know, so someone like you, George, you know, you're doing this show and you're sending out all this information, and you're changing millions of lives, and probably for the better, because they're becoming more enlightened. So, you know, all the people that you have given shown the way via this radio show, you're going to go through all that. And I would say you've got a pretty good life review ahead of you. And I think a lot of people wish they could have a life where they could do as much good as you're doing. And I think we actually can do that. And you don't have to have a radio show with millions of listeners. You can just, you know, compliment someone. Say hi to them when you're at the Safeway, the checker. Make sure she understands that, you know, you understand that she's a human being. And when your waitress comes, you know, pay her a compliment. It doesn't hurt. It only helps. And make sure it's sincere and not, you're not doing it just to have a good life review.
Right. Exactly. You're not doing it just for show, right?
Yeah, it's got to be real, because you can't escape the life review. It's inescapable. It's something so profound, and people who have had near-death experiences whom we interview in the film Infinity, you know, they come back and some of them cry for a month after their life review. Sometimes it's a cry of joy, sometimes it's a cry of pain. But, you know, this life review is extremely profound. Now, I've never had one. I've never had an NDE.
Hold on, Jay. We'll be back in a moment and find out why you've never had one when we come right back. Jay, the fact that you haven't had a near-death experience, of course, does not stop you from being able to develop programming and teach other people what it is, correct?
Yeah, I think so.
Good.
I've seen enough evidence, you know, that there's something there, and it intrigues me. And of course, I understand, I guess what Hoagland would call hyperdimensional physics enough to know that each one of us has a toroidal sphere, like a donut-shaped energy field around our bodies, and that when we are lying at the very, our bodies are lying at the very center of this vortex that is inside the donut. But when we die, this energy field doesn't die; it just rises back off the earth, unfolds into itself, and goes up a tube that connects it to the higher hyperdimensional body, which is what the tunnel is that everyone sees when they die. So I can understand it from a purely physics point of view, and so that makes me comfortable enough to know that there's a very, very large chance that there is no such thing as death. And that's what got me interested in all this was the physics. And then I went out and interviewed people and found that, you know, in certain cases, it turned out to be true. There's also, of course, I believe you may have had this guy on the phone, I forget his name, but he did interview children who had near-death experiences. And these are children who hadn't read books and had their minds fed with maybe propaganda or something, and they told their stories, and their stories told from their very, you know, young point of view, very innocent and honest point of view, relates the same exact story that the older people who have near-death experiences have, which is just going through the tunnel, meeting beings of light who say they are your real parents, and the past life review. And then you go through a session where you decide what you're going to be when you come back. And I feel comfortable enough knowing that and knowing the physics to think that there's a very, very large chance that this is all true. And that is one of the reasons that, you know, we want to make this film in a popular form so that people can see it and know themselves that this is what to expect when they die.
Why are so many people afraid to talk about death?
I don't know. I think it has to do with this idea that it's finite, that we only have one shot at it, which, if you think about it, is really unfair in the universe to just have one shot at the thing, because it could be, you know, you could be born poor or handicapped or a number of other things. And so I think that we have been taught that there's only one shot at it, and this is your shot, and you have to grab as much as you can get, and this is the basis for greed and for wars and for power struggles and all the other things, which is just so unnecessary, especially when you realize that it is not a finite existence. And I think that the powers that be foist this on us. You know, in the movie, Daniel Brinkley talks about how the government has investigated near-death experiences, but they refuse to tell us what they have found. And the reason that he says they refuse to tell us what they found is because it lessens fear. And if it lessens fear, then they lose their control, because the only way they can control us is through fear. And it's the last resort of a scoundrel, in a way. And so once you realize that you are infinite, they can't hold anything over you, and then they're in a lot of trouble. And so I think, actually, they are doing it. They don't want us to know. The power structures don't want us to know. And so in the end, this actually, you know, is the greatest subversive act of all, realizing that you do not die, that there's nothing to fear, and that you have an infinite multitude of possibilities, and that the universe is infinite. We know that already. So why, if you can go to a science course and learn that the universe is infinite, do you believe that your own life is finite? So it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And now's the time at this crucial point, as we're approaching 2012, everything is going to become unveiled. Everything is going to be revealed. And there are going to be no secrets anymore. It's already happening. It's what the Internet is about. It's what your show is about. It's what my work is about. And all the secrets are going to come undone. And one of the main secrets of all is that we are hyperdimensional beings. This is a hyperdimensional universe, and the energies do not die. They only transform themselves. And when that realization finally hits us, no one can ever tell us what to do again. And we can face the world bravely every moment and know that no matter what they do to us, that nothing is real and nothing is finite. And then they will lose their power. And we can recreate the world, which is what I really think is going on over the next 2 or 3 years. And it's all part of this playing out of forces that are going to reconstruct society from the ground up. It's not going to happen from the top down, no matter what Obama does or what Pelosi does. None of that's going to work. It's going to come from us, and we're going to reject it. And so when people get angry at, say, the Tea Party people for protesting, I think that that's actually pretty cool that there's people brave enough to go out there and protest. And I think we need to get more protests, peacefully, but more protests going. You know, during the Bush administration, you know, dissent was patriotic, and now suddenly dissent is not patriotic. Well, I think dissent is patriotic still, and we need to stand up to the powers that be, realize that they really don't have our best interests at heart, no matter what platitudes that they're telling us. And the best way to do this is to face them and all the other fears or other problems that we have without fear. And that, and every day they're cooking up another basket of fear for us, whether it's global warming or food shortages or the wars in Iran. And they're constant. It's like there's a little team somewhere that's the fear team working on what fears they can cast out today to get everybody upset and angry. And we have to realize this is all a grotesque manipulation to use our primal emotions like fear and use them against us. And we have to not be fearful and not create fear, but still be aware of what's going on, like a martial artist would.
Every civilization, though, Jay, has used fear to try to control their population.
Well, there you go. And that's exactly right, which is a great segue into where I want to go with this conversation, which is, why do they do this? Why do they use fear to control us? And that's actually the subject of my next film, Disclosure, which is going to reveal the nature of the people that have been foisting this fear on us. Now, not every civilization has used fear, because civilization is actually not the natural state of the human being. And I think that James Cameron's Avatar hit the nail squarely on the head. And have you heard of this thing called Avatar Depression Syndrome?
Oh, absolutely.
All right. Yeah. So
we did a little segment on that the day or two that Avatar came out. People got depressed, suicidal.
They did. And the question is why? And the answer is, and I know several psychologists who have told me about this, and the answer is they see the military in the film and realize that that is them. Then they see the Na'vi living in this paradise in nature, all connected together to each other and to the planet, and they realize that they have become divorced and alienated from nature, and together this creates a cocktail of depression. And I have to give James Cameron a lot of kudos because, you know, he made one hell of a film, and I knew when I walked out of the theater that it was going to be the biggest hit of all time because he got into the underbelly of our mass psychosis here on this planet, which is exactly what you were talking about. Civilization is not a natural state. It is an unnatural state that has been foisted on us by custodians who have been here with us, ruling us through fear in order that we become and stay their slaves. And they use that fear to keep us in that state. You know, slave masters, the gentleman that lynching is named after, his name was Lynch, and he wrote a book about how slave masters in the South could control their slaves. And what they did was they would take the strongest male slave and terrorize him in front of everyone else. Mm-hmm. So it would create mass fear among all the slaves, and then one plantation owner could control 100 slaves just through fear. And I think that they're doing that to us on a massive scale. And we are going to go back to a simpler time. That's what's coming towards us right now. Cameron knows that, and he made his film with full recognition of where we are headed. And this is what's going on. We're losing our civilization, and people think that that's a terrible thing. And I'm here to tell you that it may not be so bad, actually, that maybe the damage to the planet and the pollution and the wars and the struggling and the starvation and all of that isn't necessary to the human condition. Human beings are very powerful spiritual creatures, and we have amazing abilities. And civilization has caused those abilities to atrophy. And Cameron shows what a civilization is like that is deeply connected to the earth. And he also throws our own civilization right in our face in that film. And I know a lot of conservatives, and I'm fairly conservative myself, don't like Avatar, but I disagree with them. I think that Avatar is one of the greatest films ever made, and Cameron has his hand on the pulse of not the body politic, but the body mythologies. And he knows that there's a deep yearning for us to move away from a fear-based civilization back into the natural rhythms of nature. And that is where we are headed, whether we like it or not. The central operating principle of this society is gone. The jobs aren't coming back. And I'm not trying to say that to make people afraid. I'm trying to say that so that people will understand what is really going on here. I'd like to get into some of this as we get going because it will definitely help people understand what is really going on right now and what has been going on for at least 100 or maybe even longer years as the core principles of our society are taken out from under us and we are being cast adrift. We have to realize that the only way that we're going to be successful from here on in is to take personal responsibility for our lives, to develop a spiritual aspect towards each other and towards nature, and to begin to probably grow our own food and move back into semi-rural conditions.
It's easier said than done, though, Jay, isn't it?
It is. And that it's not going to be easy. Like I've said several times on this show before, you know, where we're going is going to be great, but getting there is not going to be any fun.
That'll be a bumpy road indeed.
It is very bumpy. And I think we need to understand that and start preparing now. And so I hear the ads on your show for buying seeds and people getting gardens together. I think that's the first step. And after that, we will begin a slow devolving into a semi-rural lifestyle, but we'll still have our technologies. We'll still be connected to the internet and things, but the technologies won't be so toxic and they won't be so intrusive. And this is going to happen. I guarantee it. It's in the books. I read an interview with Obama about 4 months after he was elected in the New York Times magazine, and he was saying that the central operating principle of society is gone, and that we've been cast adrift. And so somewhere he knows this. I'm not sure he has the right solutions, but I think he knows it. And I think the engineers of our society know it, and they're trying to find a way. This is why they're doing all this deficit spending. They're trying to lessen the impact of this huge shift that's happening by unfortunately spending ourselves into oblivion to keep people with food and housing and everything. But eventually that's going to stop, and we have to now start thinking about what's going to happen when they can no longer keep us supported with welfare and food stamps and unemployment. And that is, to a lot of people, a very terrifying prospect. Again, I'm not trying to scare anybody. I'm just trying to be realistic.
It's reality.
It is, and it's going to hit us like a brick. And I think, you know, if you are on unemployment, you know, enjoy it, but start planning for a way out, because it's going to come to an end, and you don't want to be end up on the street or in refugee camps or something, which could really happen. And so I want to get into in the next hour about what this central organizing principle is that's disappearing, who is behind it, these custodians who have been ruling us for 6,000 years, and the historical proof of their existence. And it's not quite what anyone else has come up with. It's a completely different theory, sort of mixed in with my work with Richard Hoagland and several historians and people who know what's going on have related to me. And when you hear it, it all makes a heck of a lot of sense. And I think when you realize that, then you can see that the central organizing principle of this society has been nothing that they've told us. It's something completely different, something hidden, something discreet that they've successfully hidden from us, because if we found out what was really going on, we would probably get very upset about it. And this goes back to my original work with the Cross of Henday, coronal mass ejection, the alchemy. It all started then, and now I think I've reached a conclusion which is going to be pretty difficult to deny once the whole thing is laid out.
But can we win, Jay?
Well, I'm an eternal optimist. And of course, since the world is infinite and I'm infinite and you're infinite, yes, we will win. But like I said, the problem with the world right now is that the managers of this world, frankly, don't want us around anymore. And they're working very diligently to remove as much of the population as they can. And see, I know that people think that the world is overpopulated and getting rid of everybody is a really good idea. But, you know, not only do I like to say depopulation starts with you, but maybe the people that have been telling us that we're overpopulated aren't exactly telling us the truth. And maybe it's really not a question of population, it's a question of resources. And when we realize that, and we realize that we have a boundless energy and resources in this infinite world, we'll no longer be afraid of what's about to happen.
And how does it all turn into 2012 as well, Jay? We'll find out when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. With your work, Infinity, how far back did you go, Jay, to look at ancient texts, for example, and what they might say about us today?
Well, actually, I went back as far as I could go. And where that is, as far as I can tell, is to a very rare group of texts called the Puranas. The Puranas are from ancient India, and they predate the Vedic texts. They're from an oral tradition that was handed down for thousands and thousands of years and finally written down in Sanskrit a few thousand years ago. And we have them today. They've been largely dismissed by Vedic scholars because of the story that the Puranas tell is so unbelievably fantastic that no one in their right mind could possibly believe them. Well, I may not be in my right mind, so I started wondering if what they were saying isn't true. And what the Puranas tell is an absolutely amazing story. First off, they say that we have been here on Earth for a long time, maybe a million years or so. They also tell us a story of ages, that there's four ages, and we start out in a golden age, and then things deteriorate. We go to a silver age and a bronze age, and finally into the Kali Yuga, or the Iron Age, which is apparently where we are right now. They also give a date for the end of the Iron Age, and that, which is peculiar. And the so there's a 60,000-year cycle between the beginning of their Golden Age. And remember, these are older than the Vedic texts. But they say that the Iron Age, this age we're in, ends in the year 2442. Well, what's interesting about that date is it's exactly 666 years after 1776. And the Puranas reveal a hyperdimensional number system of which the number 666 and 555 and 444, all these numbers are part of this system, which is apparently a way to correspond time and space. So, for instance, the zodiacal year is 2,160 years, and the diameter of the moon is 2,160 miles. And they did use a mile as their measuring back then. So anyway, what's interesting about this is that the Puranas say that at the end of the Iron Age, gigantic coronal mass ejections flare out from the sun and they cook the earth. They boil the oceans, they light the forests on fire, and everything disappears. And then it comes back after a period of quietude. The earth comes slowly back, throws the dice on new genetic forms, and this is probably, if you believe this, this is probably why biologists like Stephen Jay Gould had to resort to punctuated evolution to explain why there was no intermediate species. So what they say, though, which is really interesting, one complete four ages, according to the Puranas, is called a kalpa. And they say, and each kalpa is 60,000 years times two, or 120,000 years. They say that about two kalpas ago, a group of people on Earth decided that they didn't want to fry in the coming coronal mass ejections, which always occur. And so they, and this is what they say in the Puranas, they built giant arcs. And they went to a planet called Mahar, which is nearby the Earth. And they went underground on Mahar and waited out these coronal mass ejections. And when the Earth began to recover, they took these gigantic arcs and they came back to the Earth. And they say that these people, while they were on Mars, became transformed. All Earth peoples up until this point had a lot of pigment in their skin, and they had black hair and dark eyes, just like most people on Earth do. But when they went to Mahar, or as I believe it is, Mars, they lost the pigment, because Mars is so far away from the sun. They lost the pigment in their skin. They lost their eye color. Their hair color changed. And they got very tall because of the lack of gravity on Mars. And they came back to Earth with all of the technology from the previous kalpa all intact. And they came back to Earth 120,000 or maybe 240,000 years ago, and they discovered that some of the Earth people had managed to survive the catastrophe by probably going into caves.
Did that surprise them?
It did, and they were shocked, actually. But they were hunter-gatherers, and they pretty much left the Earth people alone and lived somewhere here on Earth, probably underground, because they couldn't take the intense sunlight anymore. And these people were known by the Earth peoples as the Aryans. What's interesting about that word is that it's directly related to Mars, because the Greek and the Vedic word for Mars is Aries. So Aryan would be the people of Aries, or the people from Mars. And these are the custodial race that Sitchin talks about, that a lot of other, William Bramley and a lot of other people talk about, the fact that there was a race living concurrently with the hunter-gatherers, which they would see their ships flying around and things. But what happened is, about 6,000 years ago, at the beginning of the Iron Age, at exactly the same time that the Mayan calendar starts its long count, they emerged out of their hiding, and they emerged fully formed, their society fully formed, in Mesopotamia, in Iraq, and they began a society. And this society had a fully developed alphabet, had fully developed languages, fully developed cultures with apparently no precedent. Like, there was no evolution towards this, and that's because they always had it. And their first leader was Sargon the Great, who created civilization. And he swept across the entire Middle East. His son Menes became the uniter of Lower and Upper Egypt. His other son went to India and began the great Aryan tradition that was in India. And these are the demigods. And I want to say this again. There's three central myths that the Earth, everybody on Earth, all the people on Earth seem to have. One is that we once lived in a beautiful garden from which we were told to get out. Two, there was a gigantic catastrophe, a flood. Everyone on Earth seems to remember this. And the third one, which I think is the most interesting, is that there is a race of, and I'll use quotes, gods, unquote, who had sex with Earth women and created demigods. There's even a movie out, Percy Jackson, I forget the name of the whole movie, but it's an interesting film about a kid around today who's actually the son of the coupling of a so-called god and an Earth woman.
Would these be the Nephilim?
They are the Nephilim. They're the Anunnaki. They're the Archons. They're the Aryans. And they're not aliens. That's why they can have sex with Earth women. And they are people who left the Earth, transformed themselves, possibly even genetically, as they waited out the catastrophe on Mars, and then came back. Now, all of this would just be pure speculation and maybe even crazy to most people, but a few weeks ago, I discovered a historian, a very erudite scholar, whose work has been completely suppressed, and his name is L. Austin Waddell, W-A-D-D-E-L-L. You can get him on Amazon. And he had the unfortunate occurrence of writing his books in the 20s as the rise of Nazism was taking place, and that may be why his work is suppressed, but I don't think so. I think his work is suppressed because he proves beyond any doubt in an incredibly scholarly manner that the Aryans are the progenitors of all civilization on Earth. And so the question is, well, why did they suddenly come out of hiding with their demigods, their bastard children who had white skin and blonde and red hair? Why did they suddenly come out of hiding? And my answer is that an alarm bell went off. They knew that they only had 6,000 years before the end of this age, which they believed was in 2442, when the coronal mass ejections would come again, and also the resultant Earth changes from the electromagnetic field disturbances and the hyperdimensional field disturbances, and they created civilization. They enslaved the Earth peoples. Let's be honest, that's what they did, and they did this to create a cognitive society that would help them build their giant arcs to get out of here. Now they ran into a problem, though, and that is that in the 1890s and early 1900s, they discovered the long count calendar of the Mayans. And when they discovered the long count calendar, which ended in 2012, they got worried because they weren't sure if the 2442 date was right or the 2012 date was right. And in order to play it safe, they decided that it was the 2012 date, and they kicked into high gear and created essentially the 20th century. And if you read the works of Joseph Farrell, you can see that from 1929 to 1945, the Nazis, who called themselves Aryans and carried all the icons of Aryan civilization, including the swastika and all the rites of the Aryans, they invented more stuff in 16 years than the human race has created before or since. They created lasers, television, radar, probably anti-gravity craft, and all sorts of other things. And this was done not to win World War II. They didn't give any, they didn't care at all whether they won World War II or not. That was not the point. The point was to develop the technologies for what I call Project Good, which stands for Get Out of Dodge. And they began building their crafts. They created a secret space program, which is why Gary McKinnon is in such trouble, because he hacked the Pentagon computers and found out about all this. And they are leaving right now. They're leaving. And I have a pair of night vision goggles, which I go out at night and look at, look up into the sky, and I'm telling you, George, there is so much flying
Something's going on up there. I know. I went up there and saw some with Ed Grimsley.
Yeah, I bought my goggles from Ed, and I'm telling you that it's amazing. I mean, there's hundreds per hour, and sometimes they're traveling, you know, in two or three at a time. And so I now have found a historian, L.A. Waddell, who confirms that it was the Aryans. And I start looking back at my work, which I did with Hoagland, and the great work that Richard has done over the years, including his recent mind-blowing discovery of Phobos, which is definitely a craft, definitely one of theirs or ours, and may even be one of the arcs that they built. And then you can go look, and you can Google this in, Hail Crater Civilization. Hail is H-A-L-E. And you can look at Joseph Skipper's great work of the image taken from the European Space Agency of a colony on Mars with farms and buildings and roads. And so I don't think Mars is anything like they told us it is. Hoagland has found out that they're coloring the images to make it look red when, in fact, there's blue skies and possibly even clouds on Mars. And I think that these Aryans have created extremely advanced craft very quickly after World War II, and they've gone to the moon. They may have already been on the moon before. Now they've created and have been spending the last 60 years creating these gigantic arcs in which they're leaving, and they're leaving now. And that's why Obama is president. That's why they no longer need to have a Skull and Boneser. Skull and Bones is originally a German secret society, and their secret number is 322. George Bush was asked what that meant by Tim Russert, and he refused to answer during the 2004 campaign. 322 is the first day of Aries, March 22nd, which, by the way, is the date that the Georgia Guidestones were christened and the date that the health care plan passed.
Interesting.
Yeah, and so what we see here is a sweep of history in which these Aryans have secretly ruled the world, and now they're leaving us with a wrecked planet, and they're leaving us behind. And this goes way into understanding who the Great White Brotherhood is, this occult, secret occult group that seems to rule everything. It shows us when you back engineer these German secret societies like Skull and Bones, you head back to the Rosicrucians, and you see, keep seeing this red motif in all of their stuff. Rosicrucian, of course, means the Red Cross. And the Rothschilds changed their name from Bauer to Rothschild, which means Red Shield, symbolically saying that they were the managers for the people of the Red, or the people from the Red Planet, of which they were. And if you back engineer the Rothschilds, you can see that they were rubbing shoulders with these upper crust Germans who were princes and royalty. Hitler was obsessed with the Vril. And the Vril is what these Aryans call themselves. And they've been living underground for the most part. They can come out at night, but the rays of the sun is too much for their skin. And if you catch an Aryan, a real Aryan, white people are not Aryans. They're the bastard children of the Aryans and humans, probably an Asian tribe of some sort. And if you catch the real Aryans, the Vril, in the right light, their skin is so diaphanous that you can see the capillary system, and they look blue.
Are they like the vampires?
They are. It's where the vampire myths come from. The pale white people who show up, and they're very erudite and very articulate and very upper crust, and they have to get back underground before the sun goes, because it literally will burn them. And they have been ruling this planet. The Tibetans say that they're guarding an entrance into the Himalayas where the king of the world lives, and he's chalk white, pale white, freakish looking. The same thing is true in the Andes. I've been to the Andes several times, and there's rumors abounding everywhere in the Andes about some people that live under the Andes that are chalk white. And in the Andes, up and down the spine of the Andes, are these German Nazi towns that are all filled with nothing but white people who have entrances into the tunnel system. Peter Lavenda has discovered that when the Chilean army finally invaded some of these towns like Colonial Dignidad, they found these tunnels going into the Andes. And let me tell you another thing, which is really astounding. The exact place where we know that they were building these craft, according to Joseph Farrell, is right where the Chilean earthquake hit. And I believe that the Chilean army and the CIA and a lot of people had gotten into these tunnel systems and found the Aryan technology and were beginning to back engineer it, and that is not allowed. And so the Aryans zapped them. They zapped the earth, and they closed the tunnel systems. They ran, according to Joseph Farrell, they ran Chile and Argentina after World War II completely. Juan Perón was one of their puppets, and so was Pinochet.
What a story, Jay. Stay with us. More to come. Jay, these huge triangular-shaped objects that people seem to be reporting, might they be what you're talking about, these arcs?
They very well may be. I don't know. I can't say. I don't know enough about them to be able to say. I know that besides what I'm seeing through the goggles and reading what Gary McKinnon has reported he found inside the files in the Pentagon, which is, by the way, why they want him here in America, to make sure he never, ever gets to say what it is he really found in any kind of detail. We can pretty much assume, I think, beyond any shadow of a doubt, that they are light years ahead of us. If these Aryans got to Phobos and got inside Phobos, then if they did this, say, 15 or 20 years ago, then they've back engineered this whole thing and they know everything. But I think they already knew everything, and they're the ones who fed the Nazis all of the information that allowed them to achieve the things that they did. And it's all part of this Project Good, to get out of Dodge. And if you think about it and you start looking back, you can see that this is what I mean when I say the central organizing principle of society is disappearing. And I think Obama actually knows this, and that because there's no need now for all of these people. There's no need for all of this industry. There's no need for any of it. And they pulled the plug on us, and we're kind of drifting around looking for something to focus on because we've essentially been mind-controlled and focused solely on the helping the Aryans achieve their task of getting out of here and getting underground on Mars. Now, they have told the managers that they've left behind, which we call the New World Order, that they can have the underground bases under Denver Airport and, you know, all over the place that they've been building. But I think the joke's on the New World Order, because if a coronal mass ejection of the size that is described in the Piranatex hits, all the oxygen is going to be sucked right out of the ground. The ions are going to pierce through through whatever covering they have, and they're going to get it. They're going to get killed. They could even get killed on Mars if it was a strong enough solar flare, but because Mars does not have a magnetic field and because it doesn't have tectonic plates, it's pretty safe there, especially if you're on the other side of Mars when it hits. So this is actually, if you examine the sun panel on the cross of Henday, you'll see that there's an angry sun face and obviously a kind of medieval artistic motif trying to simulate what solar flares look like. And then you see that there's four planets surrounding the sun, essentially saying that, you know, the four inner planets get hit. And but Mars gets hit less because it's so far out. Another interesting thing about all this is that Fulcanelli tells us that alchemy is the science of these people. And he says all alchemy begins in Aries, which is Mars. And for 20 years, I've been contemplating that and trying to figure out what that meant. And I think I've got it now, just like I think I'm pretty sure that 322 is the magic number of the first day of Aries or Mars or March. And so you start adding all of this together, a holistic synopsis is created that explains almost all of the high weirdness that's been going on and doesn't have to run off with this alien problem. They are alien in a sense. They are extraterrestrial because they left the planet for 200,000 years or whatever and came back, but they're still human. And then all of the myths begin to make a lot of sense. Andrew Collins, the great writer, wrote a book called From the Ashes of Angels. And it's all about the Book of Enoch, which is one of our oldest books, of course. And in the Book of Enoch, they tell how these Nephilim, couple with Earth women and create these demigod babies. And he goes back into the ancient texts and he describes what these babies looked like. And they're chalk white skin and white or blonde hair and shining blue eyes. And the thing is that in some tribes, these children were exalted and celebrated, and they were allowed to spread their progeny, you know, and create progeny throughout the tribes and couple with all the women in the tribes. And in other tribes, like in Africa, these were considered demon children, and they were killed. And even to this day, in several African tribes, they banish albino children from the tribe as soon as they're born and call them demon children. And that's because they don't want anything to do with these Aryans. For instance, in Jewish history, if you have a redheaded child with chalk white skin, you know, this kid is exalted among the Hebrews and among the Jews, and the same thing among the Europeans. Europeans, of course, are probably the closest related to these Aryans. I don't want anyone to go after any races or anything for what I'm saying, because it's not them. It's another group of people who have remained hidden and still remain hidden. And it seems as if sometimes they can come out into the open, and that's the stories of Count Saint Germain, who was reported to have pale white skin And he would take a white substance, a white powder, which he said protected him from the sun. And he, of course, was rumored to live 200 or 300 years, may even still be alive. What's interesting, though, is that 666 years before the end target date, of the original target date of the piranhas, is 1776. And this is, of course, when the Illuminati was began, and, of course, the United States of America. Now, my friend and anthropologist Robert Lawler, who has a great video we're putting out called The Sacred Geometry of Time next year, has gone into this whole thing, and he's really my mentor on all this and has showed me a lot of this. He shows that there are three places on Earth that in the monuments that are in these three places – now, I'll take that back. Almost every ancient monument has these hyperdimensional piranha numbers built into them. But there's three places on Earth that have them more than any others. One is the Giza Plateau in Egypt. Two is Stonehenge. And the third is the U.S. Capitol. And, you know, the implications of that are staggering. It's as if, you know, how in the world could the founders of the United States know about these ancient texts and their number systems and their history and everything, yet they appear to have, and I'm trying to say that the creation of the United States may have been to facilitate this exodus that's going on. And that's why everything that's happened in this exodus kind of started here in the United States. And the because there's no way it could be an accident that they keep putting in these geometries and these number systems into the Capitol and into the Washington Monument and even into the canal that lays between the Capitol and the Lincoln Memorial is even built on these number systems. And so you just finally, you know, throw up your hands. The Cross of Hende, of course, is also proof that someone knows about the coronal mass ejections at the end of the age. And here's the real kicker, George. If you take the word iron, which is this age, the Iron Age, it also means Aryan. It comes from the same root word. So you could say that this is the Aryan Age. And this is the age when the Aryans reemerge and create civilization, not because they're kind and want to make a great buildings and everything, but because they're creating a way for them to build these giant arcs in secrecy with us as their slaves. And I could go on and on. I have a lot of proof of this. I'm going to be putting it in my new film, which I tongue-in-cheek called Disclosure, because I know why they're never going to ever really have a disclosure, because they don't want this knowledge out. Now, NASA has to know this. They have to know it. There's absolutely no way. It's interesting that the people who founded NASA were, of course, the Germans who brought their technology here. And I think that NASA has been doing a twofold plan. One is to help facilitate this project, and two, there's a whole bunch of naive people in NASA who really think they're just exploring outer space and looking at planets and everything, and they keep coming up against these Aryan craft, and they don't know what to make of it. They, you know, they follow their crafts around. They follow the space shuttle around. They're photographed by the space shuttle. They send probes to Mars, and they find, you know, blocks of wood and statues and farmland, and they're scratching their head going, you know, what? And they don't quite get it, but maybe they will now. And when I saw Hoagland's work on Phobos, you know, I said, that's it. You know, we found one of their arcs. We know now that there's no way that that could be anything but manufactured. Interestingly enough, Tolkien, J.R.R. Tolkien, knows about this. He was allowed into the Oxford Medieval Library, of which only he could read these ancient Finnish texts, the Edda myths from the Nordic myths, and he wrote it all down in Lord of the Rings, and the elves are the Aryans. They're tall, they're blonde-haired, blue-eyed, pale-skinned, and they're leaving for the West at the end of the age. They're abandoning the Earth. And in the ancient Nordic text, leaving for the West was a euphemism for going to Mars. They literally thought that they were from Mars, that the gods were from Mars. And so, you know, you couple all of this work that I've been doing and Robert Lawler's been doing, and then you bring in Joseph Farrell and Richard Hoagland and a few other people, and the daunting truth stands before you, and there's no need for aliens. There's no need for anything too exotic, because it's really right there in front of us. And like, for instance, Kut Humi, who told Madame Blavatsky all of the things that she wrote down, she reports that he was tall and pale white. Over and over throughout the story of the occult, we find these strange, bizarre creatures who keep appearing. And frankly, from what I hear, they're quite freakish looking, these Aryans, these Vril. They're very skinny, and they have very, very white skin and huge eyes. And these are the Nords that the aliens...
That people have said they've seen.
Exactly. You know, I knew a guy who was hiking, he was an avid hiker. I knew him in the 70s, and he told me that he was hiking in the Rockies, and he saw a UFO. And he saw it land in a valley in these hidden mountains, and he hiked for 2 hours to get to where he thought he saw it land. And he looked over the rock, and he saw four very tall, blonde-haired people examining the craft. And he said they were speaking in German. And, you know, from that time on, I've been wondering, you know, what is going on here? And I think now I've reached the conclusion that the answer, while fantastic, is all in these ancient Indian texts, of which have been completely dismissed by scholars, but I think are actually the most important myths of all. And when you couple that with L.A. Waddell, and that's you can find all of his books on Amazon, and his greatest book is Makers of Civilization in Race and History, but all of his books are well worth reading. He seals it up. He ties everything together. He doesn't know about the Mars part, but he says explicitly in there. This is a guy who's a major historian at the University of London, a scholar who can read hieroglyphs, Sumerian, Sanskrit, Chaldean, cuneiform. He says that the Nephilim are obviously the Aryans, and this is in the 20s, and these books have been completely suppressed. And in this, we can also understand why the U.S. allowed the plundering of the Baghdad Museum, and maybe why we are in Iraq. They do not want these cuneiform tablets to be found, because the entire history of this thing is on them. And we know that if indeed the cover story that they told us, that, you know, Baghdadians came into the Baghdad Museum without the Marines knowing and swiped thousands and thousands of cuneiform tablets, if that's true, then they would be showing up on the black market, and they're not. I know millionaires who would really pay a lot of money to get their hands on these tablets, and they're not showing up. That's because they were not raided. The museum was not raided by the people in Baghdad. It was raided by others who don't want this story out. This is why L. Austin Waddell's work has been completely suppressed, because he found it. He discovered it. And if it had gotten out, then we would have figured this out before. Now they're leaving. And what's interesting also about this is most of what they did was in the Andes since World War II. Most of where this technology was developed was in these underground chambers in the Andes. And Jacques Vallée did a survey in the 70s of all UFO sightings and found that like 80% of all UFO sightings are in South America. If you Google,
good point.
That's true. If you Google Chile UFO or Santiago UFO, you will see a series of videos taken of 30 or 40 craft flying over Santiago in December of 2008. All through 2008 and 2007, there were thousands of UFO sightings in Argentina and Chile, and they pretty much started vanishing. What's also interesting about this is that's just about the time that the Chilean army began entering into these tunnel systems, a story that has been completely suppressed in the United States, which is big news in South America. And I believe they got in there and they found their hyperdimensional equipment and they were going to back engineer it. And the one thing the Aryans do not want is for us to uncover their technology, because then we will be equal with them, because they have nothing on us except for the technology. They're just like we are. They're just human beings. And they are leaving us behind, going to Mars to get to save themselves from this, what they believe is a coming coronal mass ejection, and they've literally wrecked the planet trying to get out of here. And we're kind of left here with a wrecked planet, and we've got to recover. I also want to emphasize that just because they believe that this is going on doesn't mean it's really going on. They could be completely fooled, too. So just because they believe that there's coronal mass ejections coming and that they have to get out of here doesn't necessarily mean any of this is true. So it's just that I'm just reporting what they believe and what they found. And these people, had I used that word, they are people. They've been here and they've been ruling us for a long time. And they've been cruel to us, to be honest with you. And they don't really care that much about us. Now they're leaving, and we have to come to grips with the fact that there's no central organizing principle anymore, that civilization actually is not the natural state. Civilization is something that is created in the Aryan age. And what's amazing is these Purana texts target the date of the beginning of this, and it's 7 years away from the opening date of the Mayan long count, 3114 BC.
Yeah, I'm beginning to think it was the 2012 date, not the 24 date.
That's the conclusion I came to. A French Freemason, and Freemasons are part of this thing, named La Plagnon, he went to Mexico, and I think he uncovered this, and he raced back to Europe to tell them about the long count calendar, and they freaked, and they hit the pedal to the metal, and everything since then has been, and this is, you know, early 20th century, has just been a gigantic manipulation, a magician's trick to hide, you know, what's really up their sleeves from us, and they're the ones who cast about all these stories of aliens and things. And if you read Joseph Farrell's new book, Roswell and the Reich, I mean, it's damning. It's a damning book about Roswell and about what they're really hiding and what Corso is really saying in his book. And I just came away from that book. You know, I wrote to Joseph and I said, my God, this is one of the most important books of the last 10 years because you just nail it completely.
Well, Joseph's been a regular on Coast to Coast, Jay, as you well know. When we come back, we'll take some phone calls, and I want to get your take on Stanley Kubrick. Jay, what does a Stanley Kubrick's 2012 have to do with this? How does that fit into the equation?
Well, Kubrick, he knows what's going on. He was rubbing shoulders with Hermann Oberth, who was one of the people who started, or one of the first German scientists at NASA. Arthur C. Clarke, I believe, knew a lot about this. I don't know how. Maybe he was a member of the Freemasonic societies. But he wanted to tell us what was really going on in A Space Odyssey, and he did tell us. And he was very concerned about the truth, and I believe he knew the truth. I not only believe that he understood what was really going on as far as what I've just told you, but he tried to tell us about the secret society in his last film, Eyes Wide Shut. Interestingly enough, one of the films that Kubrick was working on in the early 90s, but he abandoned it, was a film called The Aryan Papers, which was a film about a poor Jewish historian who was being forced, from what I've heard, being forced to write the history of the Aryan race while being serving time in a concentration camp. And so all this stuff, you know, he knows he's very high up in these circles, and he was obsessed with Nazi memorabilia. His entire house was filled with all sorts of papers from the Nazis and symbols of the Black Sun and all the rest. As one other thing I want to emphasize before, you know, so I don't make anyone misunderstand me, I don't think that the Aryans are good guys. I'm actually rather angry at them. I think that if this is all true, that they've really left us adrift and they've destroyed our planet. And I hope someone takes a pop shot at them as they're leaving. I hope Obama does. So I don't want anyone to ever think that I'm like promoting this as a good thing. I think that if this is true, it's a bad thing. And I say good riddance to them. So I just want to say that, nor do I want anyone to think that white people are some exalted race or even a race that should be killed or be angry at because they help cause this. All of this is irrelevant to the major story, and I ask people to please read your history, read up on some other things, and find out the truth. I just don't want a backlash against anyone because of what I'm reporting here. I just want the truth to get out. As for Kubrick, his entire work, his entire 13 films, are really one long film. And he is telling us a story about the secret history of the human race. And he's doing it in a way that combines icons of pop culture, film, and cinema, and puts it together so that once you start going into his films, you begin cracking the whole scheme. So 2001 is about a group of about an intervention into human affairs by a higher intelligence or a group of off-planet beings who teach us about technology. A Clockwork Orange is about how the government can mind control you to, you know, do whatever it is that they want. Barry Lyndon is about the bloodlines, the Aryan bloodlines, and how no matter how much you want to be in those bloodlines, unless you were born into them, you can never be part of them. And so Barry Lyndon is eventually, even though he tries to rise up into their culture, he's eventually rejected by them. The Shining is, of course, in my view, the secret story of Stanley and how he helped fake the moon landings. Eyes Wide Shut, which we have yet to ever see his original edit because it was edited by Warner Brothers after he died. And even though they claim that the new version is the version that he wanted, I have seen clips of the original version and they're not in the new version. So again, they don't really call it the director's cut, so which that means they're probably telling us the truth. It is not the director's cut. And the inner story of Eyes Wide Shut is about these elitists and how they have certain magical practices and occult rituals, and Tom Cruise is not allowed in. And he accidentally gets in, and his life is threatened. And even they...
What was the password, by the way, Jay? You remember it?
I do. Fidelio.
You got it.
Well, I've only seen the film about 300 times. So, but there's incredible continuity errors in Eyes Wide Shut, which Stanley would never have done. And so I think they cut certain scenes out, which may have told too much. And I believe that Arthur C. Clarke is part of this, and he's up there in the top echelon of these things. I find it an astonishing coincidence that in the book 2001: A Space Odyssey, they go to the moon of Saturn where they find the monolith, which is Iapetus, which is Japhet, who is one of the sons of Sargon, who is Sauron in Lord of the Rings. And I think that they knew. And when Hoagland uncovered his work on Iapetus and proved that it's an awfully peculiar planet or moon of Saturn, I think that he may have been on to their technologies and things. And Saturn also plays a part in this. In 2001, the astronauts were originally going to Saturn, but Kubrick at least publicly declared that he couldn't make it Saturn because he couldn't make the rings believable enough. Now, Kubrick could do anything. I think that the powers that be came in and said, no, you're getting a little too close, because Saturn is a strange planet and maybe some kind of hyperdimensional construct with its hexagonal cloud patterns at the North Pole and some of the other strange things that have been found on the moons of Saturn. It's a strange thing. And for people who don't understand a lot of this, they really need to read the work of Tom Van Flandren, the astronomer who came up with the whole exploding planet theory. The asteroid belt is an exploded planet. And according to, you know, the work that Hoagland's been doing and a few others, it could have been an occupied planet with oceans and everything. And this might even explain how, like, fishes fall from the sky. It happened in Australia about a month ago. This is the oceans of Tiamat freezing after it got exploded, and the animals freezing inside these giant snowballs, which eventually some hit the Earth, and the bodies of the fish fall down onto the planet. These are, you know, comets may actually be the oceans of this planet, frozen and drifting in wild orbits through the solar system. We know the solar system got really whacked a few million years ago, and everything is thrown off its base here. And all of this is, you know, a lot of people are pursuing this and trying to figure out the story. I'm just bringing in the Piranha text, and I'm also bringing in the films of Stanley Kubrick to show that he's trying to tell us this story also. And he's doing it in a way that doesn't offend the financial people who he needs to finance his multimillion-dollar films. So the films of Kubrick, I could do a whole show on him, and maybe someday we will. I could take each film and show you and deconstruct it and show you that Stanley is telling us a larger story under the veneer of just a regular film. And quite amazing story it is, I must say.
He was a genius. Let's go to the phones now, Jay. We'll go to Lexington, Kentucky. First-time caller is Bobby. Good morning, Bobby.
Hey, how are you guys?
Good. All is well. Thanks.
You were speaking about the real earlier. I'm really fascinated with the real, and I've read up on it. Could you just talk more about the Thule Society? And I know we have an Air Force base in Greenland. It's an Air Space Command called the Thule Air Force Base. And that is roughly in the area where the ancient society of Thule, it's almost like an Atlantean type.
Mm-hmm.
Just wondering if... I know there were some long-haired women.
Yep.
It was that Hitler and all those guys really went through for a lot of information. And it seems like I remember reading that the long-haired women really got aggravated with Hitler because he was so war-bent on, you know, destruction and killing people. And what they were really trying to do is just trying to get back to, I believe you think it's Mars. I think it was written as Sirius.
Well,
or one of the stars in a constellation.
Yeah, I mean, if you take the Piranha text all the way back, they say that originally, I mean, a long time ago, that I don't know if this is true, I'm just telling you what they say, and by the way, the Freemasons believe the same thing, that we came from Sirius a long, long time ago, and either altered the planets here and made them livable, or maybe found them already livable, and genetically created humans, and humans are part Syrians and part animals from here on Earth, if you believe what they say. And you're right, there was, I forget her name now, a very beautiful woman, a German woman who channeled the Thule knowledge. And, the the Aryans prefer the colder lands of the north. There's a lot of research from Finland and Sweden and the Nordic myths. And, of course, Tolkien got most of his stuff from the Finnish myths, which are also about these tall, blonde-headed people who share the planet with us but don't really want to live with us too much. And that's where he got most of his stuff. So, yeah, this is all part of the same interworkings of this mythology, and you can back engineer it. You can take these German secret societies and back engineer them, and you start finding out that it's just common knowledge that they think that they came from Mars and that originally they came here from Sirius long before they went to Mars or conquered any place else in the solar system. But we have to come to grips with this fact that there is stuff all over the solar system which a very highly advanced race built. And when it was built and who built it, I can't answer. I can only tell you what I've gotten from reading these ancient texts, and they tell me that we are a race that has been around for millions of years.
Next up, we go to Anthony, Florida Keys, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Anthony.
Hi. Love your show, George, and thanks for all your guests that enlighten the world so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Your guest spoke about alchemy, and I was wondering if the Aryans were possibly setting up all these locations in specific geometry, you know, special geometrical shapes to use alchemy, I mean, use our world, you know, as alchemy.
Yes, that's what they're doing. They know about higher dimensional physics, and they're creating these monuments for certain effects so that they can manipulate matter, and they're experts at manipulating matter, but any of us can do it. I want to emphasize, these are not special beings or anything. They're not anything different than anyone else on Earth. They just happen to have preserved their knowledge through the cataclysm that periodically comes. And by the way, that is considered in the Puranas to be illegal. They're not supposed to be able to escape and leave and come back. It's part of the Earth. The way that the Earth works is that periodically it's wiped clean and then started up again. And this is like a necessary thing, apparently, for proper advancement of consciousness here on Earth. And the Aryans broke the rules, and they keep bringing back the same genetic strains over and over again. And this is why, like, corn is a hybrid. It was developed by some advanced beings at some point, and I think pretty much it was developed at some Atlantean time period thousands of years ago, preserved by these people, and then brought back to Earth and started up again. And if you read, like, Fingerprints of the Gods by Graham Hancock, you can see that all over the Earth there's these myths of these people with pale skin coming and teaching people how to read and write and civilization and farming and all of that. And again, it plays right into this whole mythology that is being constructed. And I'm not, again, I want to emphasize, I think that the hunter-gatherer state is an advanced state. I know it doesn't look like it if you look at them, but if you examine hunter-gatherer societies the way someone like James Cameron has, you can see that they are very advanced societies in a spiritual sense, not in a material sense.
Okay, next up we go to Wayne in Merced, California. Go ahead, Wayne.
Yeah, hi. I have had a life experience that might shed some light on this 2012 deal.
Mm-hmm.
In the very early 70s, I had a 6 or 8 month good friendship with this guy, who near the end of the relationship there, We were having this very involved philosophical conversation relative to, you know, I told him basically a whole lot of the theories of life that I had come up with at that time. And when he said, you know, Wayne, you've almost got it right. And so I'm going to tell you something that I wouldn't tell, you know, hardly anyone. And that is that I'm an alien. So
did you believe him, Wayne?
Say again?
Did you believe him?
I didn't know whether to believe him or not. But shortly after that, now this all happened in Phoenix. Shortly after that, I took him to the bus station because he was going to, he had to go up to Fresno. And so anyway, you know, I just let him off and didn't think that much of it, except that he says, you know, I will see you again in about 40 years, and you will recognize me immediately because I will not have changed. So, you know, I thought, well, whatever. 4 or 5 years later, I watched Von Daniken's movie, Chariots of Fire, or the Gods or something.
Chariots of the Gods.
Okay. And at the, you know, and the part of the movie was that the something about the Mayan culture and something was going to happen. It was, as I recall, it said 2011.
Yeah, they well, it depends on how you do the count. Some people count the, like, of course, we have AD and BC. Some people count the year between BC and AD as 0 year, and some people don't. And now we do count that year, and so now the date is 2012 if you're doing a day count. So that's where that discrepancy comes from.
Jay, we're going to come back and take final calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Jay, tell me about your reaction to that famous Norway spiral and how that fits into things.
Well, I think that you know, Obama was receiving the Nobel Peace Prize
right.
at the same night that Putin decided to launch a missile. And, of course, we all wonder why Obama was getting the Peace Prize since he had hardly been in office.
He was wondering why he was getting
it. Exactly. And I think that I think Putin was trying to intimidate Obama by launching the missile while he was there. And I think that the guys that are leaving did the spiral, took the missile out of the sky while it was being launched and froze it in the air. And then, and we, of course, had this huge hyperdimensional weapon that was being exhibited for all to see to tell both the United States and Russia who is really in charge here and to not mess with them. You see, the thing that these guys, I mean, assuming all this is true, and, you know, I can't say that it's true. I can only tell you that they believe it's true. The one thing that these guys are worried about is we're going to back engineer their stuff and then go take off after them because we're angry with them, which we probably should be. And they don't want that. So they want us to be intimidated, and it was an act of pure intimidation, just pure and simple, both to Putin and to Obama. And Obama's peace prize may have been, you get the peace prize as long as you don't take any pot shots at us. But the thing is that if you look up at the night sky with these goggles, there is some kind of, like, war going on up there.
Something's going on up there.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what to make of it. I've seen these things, like, shooting at each other. And you can't see this with the naked eye. You got to spend a lot of money and get these goggles to see this, but it's well worth the show. And I don't know how long they're going with this. My DOD sources tell me that the night vision goggles are going to be outlawed soon. So if you can get them now and enjoy the spectacle, because I think pretty soon they're probably going to get confiscated. You know, terrorists could use them or something. Who knows?
Let's go to Vallejo, California. Paul, you're up with us. Go ahead, Paul.
Hi, George.
Hi.
Anyway, hey, I called you once before, and I'll talk about that in a second, I hope. Jay, you made a comment about the piranhas, the kind of rang hit a little biblical bone with me. You talked about the gold, silver, bronze, and iron age, and automatically my mind kind of went to Nebuchadnezzar's dream, and where you have the image of the head of gold, silver, bronze, iron. The only thing missing was the feet of clay and iron fixed together, and the stone that was not cut by human hands that came out smashed, which I would put us in a fifth age because of that, because of Christ's coming.
Well, there actually is a kind of a fifth age, which the Hindus call the Diamond Age, or it's the intervening years between where we transmute from the Iron Age back into the Golden Age. And I believe that's what's going on with Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar, is he, remember, all of the mythologies have a single origin place, and they each interpret it differently. And I think that Daniel is doing a fairly accurate interpretation of the ages. And the of course, the clay is a reddish clay mixed with iron, and it sounds a lot like Mars to me. And again, you start looking at these texts, and you start looking at the ancient, the Puranas use the word Maru for, and it means desert land, or and sometimes it means Eden. So I don't know exactly what to make of this, and I haven't had a whole lot of time to put all of the mythologies together because this stuff is racing at me so fast I can barely put it all together. But I believe that Daniel is talking about these four ages, and that when the age of iron comes, the end will come, and the Redeemer will, come and hopefully save us.
Well, let's go to Sherry in Phoenix, Arizona. You can save us. Sherry, go ahead.
Hi, good evening, gentlemen. Great topic. This is the first time that I have had the opportunity to hear you, Jay, but are you familiar with a gentleman named Brian DeFloris by chance?
No, I'm not.
Okay. I had the opportunity to meet him. George, you might know Dr. Lynn Kitai. She did the Phoenix White movie.
Sure,
okay,
yeah.
Well, I had the opportunity to see her viewing here in Phoenix in mid-March, and she met a gentleman named Brian DeFloris about a year prior, I believe it was last year, and he contacted her, and he claims to be from the Ashtar Command, the Airborne Division, and you might want to check out his website. It is beyond amazing. He talks about everything that you're going into with all of the ancient texts, but ties it together that our planet is actually transitioning, and there are several intergalactic races, I guess, that are here and coming and going, but we are going to be transitioning into, I forgot what he called it, light, seventh. What were you talking about, this Golden Age, back into the Golden Age? But he talks about a lot of this ancient text.
Yeah, he talks about a new paradigm, too, doesn't he?
Well, that is true, because once our masters, and they're not our masters, I use that euphemistically, uh-huh. Once these guys are gone, we're free now to become whatever we want. And I personally, I hope nothing happens in 2012, and we can create a society that's more just than the one that's been happening for 6,000 years. So, yeah, I think that that's exactly right. We're, the people in the Andes, the Inca, say that there's these shamans that go into the caves and can transmute themselves into light. And they say, they've told me that this is the man of the future, or the human of the future, the homo luminous, I call him. And I think that's actually may be true. And I think we've been kept from our true destiny by the slave masters, who are thankfully gone now, and we can pursue our own destiny now and not have to work for them. So I think there's a lot of truth in this whole idea of a transformation that's about to happen. I really do. The shackles have been taken off of us, and we're free to pursue our own destiny, our own goals now.
Jay, before we take final calls, tell us a little bit about Infinity. Where can you get the DVD?
Well, it's on Amazon, and you can get it at sacredmysteries.com, our site. You can also read all my articles up at jaywidener.com, jaywidener.com. I have my articles up about Kubrick and about the moon landings and Aryans and all sorts of fun topics that Coast to Coast listeners would love.
San Diego we go. Joey's a first-time caller. Welcome to Coast, Joey.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Norrie and Mr.
Sure.
Widener.
Thank you.
I would just like to say that the piranhas is part of the Vedic, huge amount of Vedic text.
That's for sure.
And there's different sections. And I was a celibate monk for 10 years and visited India. It's unbelievable. And if anybody has seen the show India by the British journalist, it was amazing. But what you're talking about is completely true. If you do all the studies and you study, there's a string that goes through all the world's religious, true religious, not just something that was made up by some person. There's a string that runs through every single religion, and it tells us that we're the soul in the body and we're reincarnated. And this age we're in right now is called Kali Yuga.
Yep.
And Yuga is the length of time, like winter, spring, summer, fall. Each yuga has characteristics.
That's right.
And the characteristics of this age is immoralism. That's why the great saints, millions of years ago, the Vedic text was sung. That's why Bhagavad Gita is called the Song of God. And so the Vedic text holds the truth, and also I do believe there are other life forms in other parts of the creation.
I'm with you. I think that the Vedic texts are incredibly important and are dismissed by Westerners way, way too much, and we need to go back and look at them, because I'm telling you, there is a lot of truth back there, and we'll understand our own religions better by understanding it. We'll understand especially Christianity, which seems very closely related to the Vedic understandings of reincarnation and the soul and the body and resurrection and all that.
2012 rolls around. Are we in trouble?
I hope not. I think we could be. I hope not. I hope we're going to get through this and get to the other side and create an equitable world where we can live in peace finally and repair our planet and get back to the things that are important, like loving each other.
Let's go to Fort Smith, Arkansas. Hello, Mary. Thanks for holding.
Hi. Thanks. I'm a longtime listener and a longtime metaphysician, and this is a very interesting topic for me. I just wanted to put in that I've received a lot of information, receiving from spirit guides and channels and seers and all of that, and spiritual studies. And one thing is very clear to me, it was not just one group of beings that were the bad guys or the good ones, but that originally when we were star-seeded, it was the Pleiadians, and our DNA was 80% Pleiadians. And then over time, the Sirians and the Orions and the Dracos primarily were the ones that they're the ones like in the Greek myths and all of that,
mm-hmm.
and Egypt, and they're the ones that kind of over time changed our DNA so that we ended up being the opposite. We're only 10% Pleiadian at this point, most people. And so it's kind of like I'm really glad that some of them are going or whatever, but we still have this DNA, and so our souls have to really shine through with love again, if you see what I mean, because they left us also with this DNA that's difficult.
Well, I'm with you. I only read books and ancient texts, so I can't really. I don't channel, and so I don't know if any of that's true. I can only report what I found in the ancient texts. And they don't really say that, but then again, they don't say it either. It's not like it could still be part of this milieu that I'm talking about. But I have to stick with the facts and as they are, and I can't get too fantastic because what I'm saying is fantastic enough. So yeah, we definitely have DNA, and we've been genetically manipulated. I'm pretty sure of that. I doubt very much whether Darwinism has much efficacy in the real way that reality works, and not to say that there isn't evolution and all that. I'm just saying that there's other forces at work. I think we're a lot older a species than we've been led to believe, and I think that, as the alchemist said, I'm a biocentrist. I believe that the human beings are one of the most important creatures in the universe. And we need to preserve our history. We need to create a destiny that's equitable. And we need to cut loose the shackles of the slave masters so that we can think for ourselves again, which we haven't really been allowed to do for a long time.
Let's go to Toronto. Steve, you're up with us. Go ahead.
Hey, George. My question was if the guest had any idea as to how this whole thing got started. Like, how did the Aryans, like, originally gain such a technological advantage over the rest of human beings?
Because they developed the technology to get off the planet before the coronal mass ejections. At the end of the Iron Age, every time we develop technologies, but they get destroyed by the coronal mass ejections. The Aryans changed the game and kept the technology and came back fully informed and didn't have to make any advances because they were already completely advanced. And they came back with all the technology from the previous age intact and waited it out on Mars, and then they came back, and then when the time clock went off, when the buzzer went off 6,000 years ago, and they realized they had to start getting moving again because the coronal mass ejections were coming, then they pulled out their technology, began giving it to us, and we began developing it, and that's how it happens. And their plan is to come back again at some time in the future with all their technology after they believe that we will be reduced back to a hunter-gatherer status.
Let's take a call from Vashon Island in Washington. Go ahead, Dexter.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good.
Okay.
Okay, I got a question about the Norway spiral and the it's called Project Bluebeam.
Oh, right. Sure.
And it's come to my attention that that kind of stuff is only happening in Russia, and the Norway spiral thing happened that very same day, though. I don't know if very many people know about this, but I wanted to know if you did, Jay, was that pyramid that was floating over the Kremlin for, like, the good part of the afternoon?
Yep,
that was weird. Jay, 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Yeah, they're connected. It's the Aryans giving everybody a warning, a heads up that this is it and don't mess with us. And we're leaving, and don't mess with us. That's what it's about. And we're in charge, and you can't do anything about it. Of course, I completely disagree with that.
Project Bluebeam, of course, supposed to be a false flag of some kind of a hologram that would be set up to make us think that there's a UFO invasion. Right?
Exactly, of which will not happen. And they're not going to disclose aliens. Don't count on it. None of that's going to happen. The bottle is tightened up, and the lid will never come off.
You got it. Thank you, Jay, for being on the program. Jay's website,
you,
linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Now he's got two, jaywidener.com, W-E-I-D-N-E-R, and sacredmysteries.com as well. Fascinating guest. Thank you so much, Jay, for being on the program. Next program, we talk with John Searle about the John Searle story. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Landeseur, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.